A key employment number hits its best mark since 2008.
Is it a seasonal present, or has the job market really turned a corner?
From APM, American Public Media, in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, December 15th.
There's a huge spending bill battle going on in Washington, Jeremy, and the government could shut down because of it?
Again, the battle could affect who gets what money for a college education.
And Will Ferrell pitches beer. But not the beer you might think, or in the place you might think.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The government said this morning that the number of people applying for unemployment benefits dropped last week to 366,000. That's the lowest level since May of 2008.
But what does the big drop signify? Ellen Zentner is senior U.S. economist at Nomura Securities, and she is pinch hitting for Diane Swonk on the show this morning. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So is this number all about seasonal factors? I know there's a lot of people being hired for short-term holiday jobs, or is this really good news?
Well, I'm going to venture to say that it's really good news. Retailers hire more strongly around the holiday season every year, and the Department of Labor, the government outfit that officially puts out these initial jobless claims data, they account for that in these numbers. So they adjust to account for the fact that retailers typically hire strongly around this time of year. So, you know, we're taking this decline in initial jobless claims in the latest week as a good sign that job growth is accelerating.
Okay, a good sign. Now, what about this sign coming from Washington? We're less than 2 days away now from another possible government shutdown if Congress can't pass this short-term spending bill. What are your economic concerns as you look at what's happening in Washington?
Well, the concerns for the U.S. economy is that all of this policy uncertainty coming out of Washington certainly does not help household confidence. It doesn't help business confidence. It really impacted the U.S. economy over the summer months when we were at that time looking at a possible government shutdown. Here we are going through these same issues again, and I fear that they're not going to lessen much in 2012 surrounding the national elections. And so, you know, it just underscores the fact that people are very concerned about problems going on in Europe and how they might affect us here in the U.S., but we have problems of our own here, and it's stemming from our own government and the indecision and failure to work together.
Ellen Zentner, senior U.S. economist at Nomura Securities, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As a possible government shutdown looms over the next couple of days, we're going to hear a lot more about the payroll tax cut that's set to expire. But there's another tax cut on the line that's for innovators, research and development, the kind of people who might be working on the next Google or maybe Facebook, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The research and development tax credit is renewed annually, but it can take a decade to get a great idea to market. Is this any way to run an innovation economy? William Solomon at Harvard Business School puts it this way. Suppose you're developing a new gas that costs just a buck a gallon. You face lots of challenges: technology, customers, idea theft, and, thanks to DC, financial unpredictability, too.
Uncertainty is what I always call a corrosive hidden tax. It's one thing I'm going to take on uncertainty or risk that I can manage, but I'm going to be far less likely to take on additional risks that I can't manage. And as we now know in Washington, I can't predict anything.
Solomon says a better, cheaper gas is good not just for the inventor, but for society. So he argues the feds should encourage innovation. Independent studies suggest tax breaks do pay off. They stimulate research, and they cut the cost of developing the next big thing by 6 or 7%. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Meanwhile, as this budget battle looms, there are proposed changes to federal student aid programs. It could have an effect on who gets to go to college. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
When college students take out loans subsidized by the federal government, Uncle Sam pays the interest for the first 6 months after they graduate. Terry Hartle is a lobbyist with the American Council on Education. He says Congress is expected to end that grace period.
The good news is the cuts that we are looking at are far less than almost every observer predicted.
The savings on interest payments will help pay for federal grants for low-income students under the Pell program. But Hartle expects cuts there, too. He says students will only be eligible for the grants for 6 years instead of the current 9, and they'll have to have a high school diploma or an equivalent. Mark Kantrowitz with FinAid.org says those students are more likely to graduate.
If the goal of spending federal money is to produce college graduates, you'd want to focus that funding on the students where it's going to make a difference.
But Congress may also make it harder to qualify for the maximum Pell Grant, about $5,500 a year, and that could price more low-income families out of a college education. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Of course, we do the numbers for the markets. Now let's take America's temperature on the global economy.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
It's time for the attitude check when we touch base with a polling firm Gallup about what Americans are thinking on economic issues. A U.S. House panel today will be talking to economists and others about the threat the European debt crisis poses to the American economy. Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief, and he's with us now to talk about it. Morning, Frank.
Good morning.
Where does the European debt crisis rank on Americans' list of concerns?
That's an excellent question. We don't find it show up at all in our most important problem question that we ask every month. What's the most important problem facing the country? Now, it may be hidden behind the economy, because a lot of Americans volunteer that the economy just generally is the number one problem, but we don't see the European debt crisis mentioned specifically. We did find a question from about a month ago asked by another organization where they put in front of the public the idea of giving financial assistance to nations which have in turn assisted Greece. 71% of Americans said absolutely not. They weren't in favor of that. So it suggests to us that the public is not totally locked into believing that the European debt crisis is highly important to Americans.
Much of a concern there. All right. So one of the debates that's going on in Europe, though, Frank, is over governments and whether they should cut spending and balance their budgets or try and boost the economy. That same debate is going on in this country. Do Americans have an opinion on that?
Let me give you a couple of thoughts here. One, we did ask Americans a while back, what's the number one thing to do to create jobs? And Americans said, bring jobs back from overseas. Mm-hmm. No answer given as to how to do that. But then Americans volunteered, a number of them, infrastructure spending, stimulate the economy. But just as many said, pull the government back and don't get the government involved. That shows you the ambiguity there. But we did have a question that we asked a while back. We're very specific. Do you favor spending government stimulus money, direct investment in infrastructure and stuff, in order to, and this is the important point, create jobs and stimulate the economy? And when we said it that way, 60% of the American public agreed.
You think that'll factor into the election?
Oh, absolutely. I think the number one issue in this election is, of course, the economy, but right behind that is the role of government. And this is this issue. Does the government function best as an actual instrument that brings about positive things? Or is the best government less government? I think it'll be a key issue in the election.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief over at Gallup. Frank, thanks.
You bet.
And now to the marketplace global perspective. Steve, of course, today marks the end of the U.S. war in Iraq.
Yeah.
And they're having a ceremony there in Baghdad. Meanwhile, in the U.K., the senior-most military leader there is warning of the newest threat to that country's national security – the Eurozone debt crisis. Mm. General David Richards said in a lecture yesterday, the crisis poses the biggest strategic threat to Britain right now. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
General Richards said his main worry is the ability of Britain's European allies to maintain their armed forces. He fears that austerity and slow economic growth in the Eurozone may further dent defence budgets there. And he's nervous about the UK's own defence spending. If the euro collapses, Britain's economy could shrink by up to 8%. Peter Felstead is editor of Jane's Defence Weekly.
One of the greatest defences this country can have is to have a strong economy.
And from that comes everything else, the ability to procure decent defensive capabilities, for example.
In his lecture, General Richards also expressed concern about defense cuts in the US and that America intends to switch its main military focus away from Europe to the Pacific and Southeast Asia. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Ministers from the World Trade Organization are meeting in Geneva today, and they're about to send an invitation to Russia to join the group. It's going to be the biggest addition since China joined 10 years ago. Peter Van Dyke has more from Moscow.
Russia is the last big world economy outside the WTO. It's taken 18 years to agree the terms. That shows lingering doubts both inside and outside the country. Sergei Yushin heads Russia's National Meat Association.
Russia would need about 8 to 10 more years to pursue independent industrial and agricultural policy to get ready to be more competitive when we really enter this WTO world.
Yushin says Russia's agricultural sector is just taking off, and a flood of cheap imports from the US and Europe would set it back.
We understand that we need this competition to modernize ourselves, to become more and more efficient. But this is really the worst possible time for opening the gates so widely.
Open they will, though, and it's not just foreign food producers who are looking to profit. Art Franchek is the president of the American Institute of Business and Economics in Moscow.
High-tech goods will have a zero tariff. So the high-tech companies are going to have a big opportunity in this country.
Russia hopes abolishing tariffs on high-tech goods will help it to modernize. After all, Russians want cheaper smartphones and tablets as much as anyone else. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Starting today, the Chinese government says it'll levy duties on imported cars made in the United States, which came as a big surprise to U.S. automakers. As Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai, it's the latest move in what's becoming a nasty trade spat between the U.S. and China.
For U.S. automakers that export cars to China, here's the good news about these new fees.
There's no colossal setback here.
Auto industry expert Michael Dunn says these duties will impact less than 5% of U.S. cars sold in China. That's because many automakers don't export to China. They make what they sell domestically through joint ventures. But here's the bad news for U.S. automakers.
China has targeted the most profitable cars that American companies sell into China.
Vehicles like big SUVs that aren't typically made in China. So why is China doing this? Dunn says it's revenge. The U.S. recently launched an investigation into China's solar industry. U.S. solar manufacturers allege Chinese solar companies are illegally dumping their panels onto the U.S. market. If the U.S. wins the case, Chinese solar companies stand to lose billions in sales to U.S. consumers, and it would represent a significant step in what is becoming an increasingly ugly trade dispute between the world's two largest economies. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, while winter officially starts 1 week from today, Jeremy, here in the United States, it is summertime in the Southern Hemisphere, right?
Of course.
Where
yes,
the toilets
right.
flush on the other way, right? Don't they go the other way? Anyway. In Chile, government officials say they have the perfect way men can help save the environment when it gets hot.
Yeah.
Can you take a guess? What do you think it is?
Turn off the air conditioner.
Well, it's a way to turn off the air conditioner. It's a sort of cause and effect. Shed the tie.
You mean take off your tie.
Take off your tie. Because you're going to cool off a little
That's
bit, right?
That's
you can
true.
Unbutton
That's
that
true.
Top button, maybe the second button from the top, too. Some people do that, right? In a bunch of TV spots, the country's economic minister whips off his tie and unbuttons the top of his shirt. And, of course, this is the line. You know, a tieless society of men, the government says, will reduce the need for air conditioning. So less air conditioning, of course, less power used, all of that. It'll also reduce the need for dry cleaning after lunch because you don't get your tie dipped in the soup. You know?
They're keeping things a little bit more chilly in Chile.
Oh, man.
Well, it is debate time again in the Republican race for president. Tonight, the candidates, Steve, are going to meet in...
Where are they? What is this, the 45th?
478th debate. They're going to be in Iowa.
Wait, there they are outside the parking lot, Jared.
But this is going to be the last one before the Iowa caucuses.
Right.
And according to the polls, of course, House Speaker Newt Gingrich has jumped into the front-runner position in recent weeks. So we're going to talk Newtonomics now with historian Steve Gillen. He is the author of The Pact, Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich, and the Rivalry That Defined a Generation. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what would be the biggest economic change, do you think, under President Gingrich, if it comes to that, given what we know about him?
I think a lot of it depends on whether or not he has to deal with a Democratic Congress. Gingrich has shown when he was Speaker, especially in the final phase of his speakership, that he is willing to reach across the aisle and form bipartisan relationships. There are two Newt Gingriches. Gingrich has always made a distinction between politics and governance. For him, politics are the inflammatory things you have to say in order to gain power. Once he's in power, he is more compromising and more willing to propose bipartisan solutions. When I did my research on the relationship between he and Clinton, I was amazed that the policy people in the Clinton White House all told me that behind closed doors, where there are no cameras there and a lot of other people to play to, that Gingrich was always trying to make a deal. They found Gingrich easy to deal with.
Well, what do we know about where he stands on the big economic issues of the day?
Gingrich doesn't really have a well-thought-out economic philosophy. All the issues are all framed based on his sense of what works politically. So he doesn't sit around with economists and say, okay, these are the issues that are going to be the best for America. He sits around and says, what issues can I pick and choose from that are going to undermine Democrats and improve my position?
Well, there's one economic idea that's gotten a lot of attention that he has said that we should change the child labor laws in this country.
Yeah. That's typical Gingrich. You know, Gingrich comes out with wacky ideas. It won't be the last crazy idea from Newt Gingrich that we hear on the campaign trail. It's not something I think we'd have to worry about if he became president.
Steve Gillen, author of The Pact, Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich, and the Rivalry That Defined a Generation, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we'll be talking about the economic policies of the other candidates in the coming weeks. And we've got more on all of them at Marketplace.org.
Well, the deflated maker of BlackBerry smartphones, Research in Motion, reports earnings today. Used to be the BlackBerry was a big status symbol. I think everybody had a BlackBerry. Oh, I'll pull out my BlackBerry. Nowadays, more business users are reaching for iPhones. Sally Herships tells us why BlackBerry's share of the pie is shrinking a bit.
Poor BlackBerry. The phone used to be so popular, it was called the Crackberry. Kartik Hosanagar teaches at Wharton. He says customers are just not thinking about the devices as much as they used to.
When they do, they think of a boring product that is not for them, that is for business users who might use it for work.
But even executives are kicking the BlackBerry habit. Used to be that IT departments insisted on BlackBerry because of its secure network for email. Then came BlackBerry's October outage. RIM has also been late with touchscreen technology and hot features like apps. Meanwhile, business users have been snapping up iPhones and Androids. Anil Doradla is a tech analyst with William Baird.
So at the hardware level, at the operating system level, and at the application storefront level, they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
If only smartphones were RIM's only problem. Earlier this year, the company wrote off $500 million because its new tablet, the Playbook, didn't play well with consumers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
News from the world of sports today. Star point guard Chris Paul is moving to Los Angeles to play basketball, but not for the L.A. Lakers. Instead, Steve, he's going to be suiting up for L.A.'s oft-forgotten basketball step-sibling, the L.A. Clippers.
Oh, is that what they're called? Okay. Well, Paul, of course, is one of the league's most identifiable and talented players, and he's been sought after by many teams after the league and players agreed to their collective bargaining deal to save the season. Of course, we're going to have basketball by Christmas is what we've been told. Here to talk with us is the authority on all things Clippers, Kevin Arnovitz, who's with us from here in L.A. Hey, Kevin.
How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Kevin, let me ask you first to just sort of give us the brief back and forth, because I know there's been some stuff going on with Chris Paul the last few days. What happened and why is this such a big deal?
Well, it was sort of a confluence of events. First of all, Chris Paul
played for the New Orleans Hornets, the only team that is actually owned by the league. It's been struggling financially, so the league had to sort of take over as a custodian. So they were in a very awkward position. So here they had a superstar point guard who wanted out, was sort of demanding a trade, but the league has very much a vested interest in sort of keeping players put and also, you know, letting small market owners know, hey, we're not going to let superstars dictate where they're going to go and sort of bust their way out of your markets. The Lakers and Rockets had proposed a trade that would have sent some really good players to New Orleans last week, and the league vetoed it, which sent the Twitterverse and the social media world and basketball fans into a tizzy. And so the Clippers sort of stepped in and filled that vacuum. They have a bunch of young players, a draft pick, some expiring contracts, the kind of stuff that teams that are looking to rebuild really value. And so they put together a deal, and then finally, yesterday afternoon, the Clippers and Hornets came to an agreement.
Now, Kevin, I want to ask you, because the L.A. Clippers, yes, they are the little brother team in L.A., but it's still L.A. I mean, is this sort of just another example of the big cities in the U.S. hoarding all the talent in the NBA?
Those bad big cities, bad.
And that was one of the big issues with the collective bargaining agreement. Players who have kind of all-star elite status want the opportunity to do what everybody in every other field does. You know, if you're the top graduate out of MIT, nobody tells you you got to go work for that little startup in Silicon Valley rather than, say, Google. And that's what superstars like Chris Paul and their agents would tell you. They're just exercising sort of the franchise that every other person who toils at their craft gets to do.
You've been following the Clippers, right, for a long time, and it sort of is the redheaded stepchild of L.A. How big a deal is this for the Clippers? And you know, Chris Paul isn't as famous as Kobe or LeBron James, but is he now going to be more marketable? Will that sort of magnify his success?
Infinitely so. And it's a great, great thing for the Clippers. Last year, their rookie Blake Griffin blew up on the scene. He's a dunking machine who quickly became television, YouTube, social media favorite. And so now you pair him with one of the most dynamic point guards in the league, Chris Paul. And this will lead to only more alley-oop dunks and more sponsorship opportunities for the Clippers and the potential to tinker with their broadcast deal, which is just what a fraction of what the Lakers are able to generate in the LA broadcast market. So it's a huge deal for Chris Paul as well. Los Angeles is a playground for NBA players. There are all sorts of ancillary and extracurricular activities, both good and bad, that are available to NBA stars. And for him, it's going to be paradise.
Kevin Arnovitz covers the NBA for ESPN, and he knows a lot about the LA Clippers, and he talked to us this morning. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
And finally, Steve, there are some new local TV ads that are on the air in Davenport, Iowa, that the actor Will Ferrell decided he wanted to do for free.
The anchor man himself.
He called the company that makes old Milwaukee beer, that would be Pabst Brewing Company, and he asked them, can I do these ads for free?
Wow.
And here's one of them.
When I'm not too busy being a big-time Hollywood phony, I like to come out here to Davenport, sit on my favorite log and crack open a ice cold old Milwaukee. Something I do. Well, truth be told, I've never been to Davenport. This is my first time, but it's something I want to do, you know?
Now, Steve, it remains unclear why Ferrell chose Davenport, because, of course, the beer is from Wisconsin.
Right, right. Yeah, he's a few states off.
And it's also unclear why he is such a big fan of old Milwaukee beer, because we went online and looked, and the online beer reviewers give the beer a D+.
Well, you know, it's cheap beer. I mean, you know, let's just face it. You can buy a sixer for, like, what, $3 or $4?
That's
at
right.
the grocery store.
Maybe
I mean,
he wants to get in on the presidential election stuff going on in Iowa right now. Get those ads on the air so that people don't have to watch as many campaign ads. I don't know.
It could be. He could be catering to the college crowd wants cheap beer, of course.
There
they can't
go.
Afford anything more than that.
Or maybe he just
they
wanted
can't get
to go
your kind of beer.
Maybe he just wanted to go sit on a log in Davenport. Maybe we should just take
There's
him at his word.
Nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Thursday, and thanks for tuning in to the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.